The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is already my 50th program for the year. It's hard to believe. It seems like the calendar year 2019 just started, but here we are, 50 programs into it. In fact, I looked at the kpcg.fm website this morning as well, and we're on, as of yesterday's posting, we're on program 943, so as I was telling Sam earlier this year, when we get to 1,000, sometime, I guess, over the summer, we'll have to have a big party, a big special show, maybe some clips from way back when. 2015 is when it all got off and running, and now here we are, almost, not quite, but almost 1,000 programs later. Speaking of programs, yesterday's show, we had some technical difficulties, but we patched it together and posted, I think, a 40-minute program. And I refer to it because there is some really interesting and exciting audio from that program. We played the PCG, this is the PCG video that we used on the online pack. And then also, there was about an eight-minute video or audio that Sam put together following our campout up in Scotland. So some good history there if you want to go back and listen to some of those sound bites. That's on yesterday's program posted at thetrumpet.com. On today's show, we've got a lot to get to. We'll talk about Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, his visit to Israel. Of course, President Trump got lots of headlines yesterday with his tweet about the Golan Heights, and so we'll look at that. And also, later on in the show, we'll pull our Bible study material out of the book of Esther in the Old Testament. First, we have James Comey as an op-ed in the New York Times today, and he's telling the world what he wants from the Mueller report. Comey, if you remember, he's the one who helped trigger this investigation almost 2 years ago. This is what he said in I think it was a Senate testimony on June 8th, 2017, clip 7.
So I asked a friend of mine to share the content of the memo with a reporter. Didn't do it myself for a variety of reasons, but I asked him to because I thought that might prompt the appointment of a special counsel.
So he wanted to leak those memos to the New York Times so that he could hopefully prompt the appointment of a special counsel. And he got his wish. The ploy worked. Robert Mueller was appointed just a few days later. May 17th, I guess it was, 2017. And now, according to his op-ed this morning, now Jim Comey, he doesn't really care how the investigation turns out. He doesn't really care one way or another. He's rooting for the United States justice system. He wants the rest of the world to see that it actually works. It says here, the rule of law, this is Jim Comey, the rule of law depends upon fair administration of justice, which is rooted in complete and unbiased investigation. It's pretty rich for him to be saying this, given the way that they approached the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server or her activity in setting up that illegal server, and then the way they've gone about the investigation of President Trump. It says, we are best served when an investigation finds all relevant facts and illuminates the fullest possible view of the truth. So as I say, this is Jim Comey talking about upholding the rule of law. Further on in his piece, he says, but because the Department of Justice is guided first and always by the public interest, it should provide details about finished investigations when the public needs to know them, as it has traditionally. So of course, we've got to make it known to the public. Who knows what's in this? Now, even Rod Rosenstein himself has said that if there's just some information in there and there's no indictments to come from it, we can't just release that to the whole world. Not if it slanders someone's reputation. But here's Jim Comey now saying that, well, this is just the way it's been done traditionally. We've got to make it known. Well, even the president himself has said, fine, put it out there. Let the American people decide. That's probably what will happen. I would imagine some things will be redacted. Just again, in the interest of concealing details about investigations or accusations that that never did pan out. In any event, everything regarding Donald Trump, that's already out there. So that's probably why the president is not really that concerned. But think of the double standard. The standard for one, a political opponent, and the standard for the one they wanted to be president of the United States. There is a story from Judicial Watch. I guess they've been engaged in some kind of lawsuit to try to get some of those Hillary Clinton emails that have been recovered by the FBI, or that were recovered going back a few years. But Judicial Watch says here that Clinton declared under penalty of perjury in 2015 that she had directed that all my emails on ClintonEmail.com, that's the server she set up in her basement, she said under oath that all of her emails were turned over, basically. They were turned over. And, of course, that wasn't true. Judicial Watch says in 2017, the FBI uncovered 72,000 pages of documents Clinton attempted to delete or did not otherwise disclose. Until the court intervened and established a new deadline, the State Department had been slow-walking the release of these documents at a rate that would have required Judicial Watch and the American people to wait until at least 2020 to see all the releasable Clinton material. It says the production of documents in this case is now concluded, with the FBI being only able to recover or find approximately 5,000 of the 33,000 government emails Hillary Clinton took and tried to destroy. The FBI, that's been finding any and everything on Donald Trump and anyone associated with him, and of course they've made a lot of it up as well, but they could only get to 5,000 of those emails. 28,000, I guess, just totally destroyed. Well, Judicial Watch got to some of these documents because of a Freedom of Information Act request. And so they're being made known. It says here, this final batch of Clinton emails includes five new classified emails and communications with controversial figures Lanny Davis and Sidney Blumenthal. It talks about an exchange that she had in 2011 with Prime Minister Tony Blair. It was classified information. A classified email exchange between Blair and Clinton took place in January 16th, 2009. This was just days before Barack Obama was inaugurated. So here she was interacting with world leaders even before President Obama was president, or before he became president. This is standard practice for the incoming administration to interact with world leaders. But when the Trump transition team does it, then there's all these calls for the Logan Act and so on. Well, I won't take you through that from a couple of years ago. But listen to this. An email with the subject line Clinton Ivanishvili meeting shows a meeting with pro-Putin Georgian billionaire Bidzina Ivanishvili, who was reportedly involved in a Russia rigged election for president of the Republic of Georgia. Now, you can expect for this to get absolutely zero attention today from the mainstream media. Hear this interaction with this Georgian billionaire reportedly involved in a Russia-rigged election. It says on May 29, 2012, longtime Clinton political operative Craig T. Smith emailed Cheryl Mills asking if a meeting between Secretary Clinton and Georgian billionaire Ivanishvili was happening, saying, would be good thing, this would be a good thing if it could work out. Further on, there's one here that says, the documents uncovered, just one more, the documents uncovered by Judicial Watch also include an email to Tamara Luzzatto, former chief of staff during Clinton's tenure as U.S. Senator for New York. Clinton talks about getting a secure computer set up soon. Tamara, this is my new address, but please know I cannot check it during the day unless I leave my office. I hope to have a secure computer set up soon to be able to get email during the workday. Much love, Hillary. So, of course, when it was controversial, when it was being investigated, we were led to believe that she was just kind of clueless. She didn't really understand the technology. Here she is. Here she is talking about, hey, I'm about to get this server set up. I'm about to set up a secure computer in my house. She knew exactly what she was doing. Exactly what she was doing. And she had a lot of helpers like Cheryl Mills. Helpers in setting it up. Helpers in destroying the emails. And all of them, every single one of them, they got off scot-free. And so here comes Jim Comey talking about the rule of law, praising the Department of Justice. Think about that article, the one we refer to so often, my father's piece last year, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. He says in that article that if Hillary Clinton had been elected, all of these destructive trends that were continuing through the Obama years, 8 years of it, it would have just continued. And as he said, it would have meant the end of our constitutional republic. My father said in that piece, referring to the Trump administration, he said Donald Trump is a man with serious problems, but the radical left is relentlessly waging war against the president and leading this country to its destruction. And it was only Mr. Trump's election that prevented even worse troubles from bringing this nation down even more quickly. It's astounding, really, to think that he even got in there, given what he was going up against. And now you look at him. Now you look at the economy. I think the president just tweeted out this morning, 3.1% GDP for the year. Best number in 14 years. You've got the fastest growing GDP in more than a decade. 1 million job openings. Record low unemployment. 7 straight months of 3% wage growth. Not all of these additional regulations added every day, but deregulations. We haven't heard that in a while. Victor Davis Hanson, he had an article today or yesterday, can Trump win again in 2020? He said in 2016, Donald Trump overwhelmed 16 qualified Republican primary rivals and became the first major party presidential nominee with no prior political or military experience. No experience whatsoever, except in the world of business. Hanson says, against even greater odds, Trump defeated in the general election a far better funded and more politically connected Hillary Clinton. He talks here about how that he had no record. Well, now he's got a record. Not just campaign statements or promises. He's got a record. It says, of course, his base supporters and furious opponents have widely different views on the Trump economy and foreign policy. It's going to come down to those in the middle. But at this rate, as Hanson brings out, at this rate, he's looking pretty good. His administration is looking pretty good for 2020. Politico had a piece how Trump is on track for a 2020 landslide. Hansen says here, yet many independents will see successes since 2017. They'll see a successful track record, even if some are turned off by his tweets. Still, if things at home and abroad stay at about the same or improve without a war or recession, Trump will likely win enough swing states to repeat his 2016 Electoral College victory. So already, some voices from the right and the left wondering if the stage is set for him to get reelected. His administration just keeps chugging along, even against all of this resistance. I mentioned the tweet about the Golan Heights. He sent it out yesterday. After 52 years, it's time for the United States to fully recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which is of critical strategic and security importance to the state of Israel and regional stability. And let me tell you, they're excited about this statement in the little state of Israel. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was visiting Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday. And listen to Netanyahu praising him, thanking him in the United States for this recognition. This is clip six.
This evening, I just want to say one word, two actually. Thank you. Thank you, Mike Pompeo. Thank you, President Trump. And thank you, America.
That was the Israeli Prime Minister yesterday thanking the president for his statement on the Golan Heights. If you remember earlier this month, Israeli authorities uncovered this vast underground terrorist network on the Syrian side of the Golan Heights. Iran is in there for good now, and they've been pushing up. In fact, we just visited the Golan not too long ago, last year, I guess in the spring. Maybe it was in June, I forget which, but we were up there right at the border, basically, overlooking Syria and all these villages that had taken such a beating during the Syrian civil war. And now that ISIS has been crushed, you've got Iran moving into these regions, pushing right up against the Israeli border. This is the IDF spokesman earlier this month when he was announcing the activity, the terrorist activity, going on right at Israel's border with the Golan Heights. Clip one.
Today, the IDF is exposing a Hezbollah terror network on the Syrian Golan Heights aimed at striking Israel. The network is comprised of a few operatives, Syrians, but it's led by Lebanese and masterminded by Hezbollah. The main guy behind it is a known terrorist called Ali Musa Dakduk, and for American ears, he has history. He was responsible for the abduction and execution of five American servicemen in Iraq in 2007. He even served time in prison in Iraq and was then released in a prison swap. He then came back to Lebanon and to Syria, this time with a new mission. Now what we have today is an infrastructure masterminded and operated by Hezbollah from Lebanon, but on Syrian soil, using the local civilian infrastructure, using them as observation points, collecting intelligence against Israeli targets. And we have a clear message. We're not going to allow Hezbollah to establish a terror infrastructure on the Golan capable of striking Israeli civilians.
That's Israel's message for Iran and the terrorists right at their border at the Golan Heights. And then yesterday, the President of the United States comes out and fully endorses it. After 52 years, of course we should fully recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. The international community hasn't done this. The UN certainly hasn't done this. I can remember a tour through the Golan, and we visited, we drove by an Israeli defense position, an outpost for the IDF. And then also there's a UN outpost up there. And so we were sitting down inside this UN facility, listening to one of the UN guys give a speech about that region. And he basically talked about it as if it was Syrian territory. Here we are. Here we were in Israel. And of course, that whole region, the Golan, it's just been prosperous these past 50 years. It's become, as one author said, a model of prosperity and coexistence. The Druze were pretty much wiped out in previous wars. And now they're a small still. I think they have 20,000 people, 27,000, I believe it is, 27,000 Druze. But they're a thriving community. And, of course, Israel, these past 52 years, they've opened up citizenship rights for the Druze. Quite a few wineries up in the Golan. It's a beautiful area. But here is this UN guy saying that, yeah, well, it's not really Israel's territory. Well, turn it over to Syria then, and then see how freely you can move in there with the Iranian militias setting up shop to target Israeli citizens. Yesterday, this was before the announcement from Donald Trump, but in one of the press conferences with Mike Pompeo and the Prime Minister, Prime Minister Netanyahu was talking about just how important it is for Israel to control this region. Let's see. I think this is clip two.
Just last week, we uncovered efforts by Hezbollah, an Iranian proxy, to build a terror network in Syria on the Golan Heights. And I can say that all of you can imagine what would have happened if Israel were not in the Golan. We would have Iran on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. I think for this reason and for many more, I think it's time that the international community recognize Israel's stay in the Golan, the fact that the Golan will always remain part of the state of Israel.
That's him yesterday urging the international community to recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan and saying, what would happen if we weren't there? In Tablet magazine from earlier this month, it says here that Iran's presence in Syria is now a done deal. Whether at the hands of Iranian soldiers or proxies, the security equation we had known these last few decades on the border between the Israeli and the Syrian sections of the Golan has changed. Listen to this. It says the border between Israel and Iran, between the West and radical Islam, now passes through the Golan Heights. Remember, the Golan Heights, it borders with Syria. Syria's just made it through this horrific civil war, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of casualties, people murdered, ISIS, the ISIS rampage, Russia comes in, Iran comes in, the United States leaves. All of that's right at the border of Israel. The border between Israel and Iran, between the West and radical Islam, it passes through the Golan Heights. Tablet says here, Iranian militias, looking a lot like Hezbollah, are digging into bases on the border with the Golan. The Shia population in the area grows larger, and rocket supplies threaten the Israeli residents of the Golan Heights and the eastern Galilee. Of course, that's why they captured that area in the first place. Because Syria was just raining down bombs on Israel. 1967, 1973, lots of Israelis, thousands of Israelis sacrificed their lives in the Golan Heights. Well, Syria had it for 21 years. And Israel's had it now, as the president tweeted, for 52 years. And it does provide at least a more secure buffer between these states, Hezbollah, Syria, now Iran, Iranian militias, a buffer between all of that and the Galilee. They'd be right on the shores of the Galilee were it not for Israel occupying that territory. The New York Times today, in reporting on the president's tweet and the U.S. going forward, it says President Trump declared on Thursday that the U.S. should recognize Israel's authority over the long-disputed Golan Heights, delivering a valuable election eve gift to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but jettisoning decades of American policy in the Middle East. See, to the Times, it's just all political. In fact, the New York Times says that, or it makes the suggestion that this was just Netanyahu working behind the scenes, twisting President Trump's arm. They hate Netanyahu. They want to see him go down in the April elections. And so this is all political. This is Donald Trump meddling in Israeli politics. And that's the way they see it. It says, but Trump's move, while popular in Israel and among some lawmakers in Congress, is likely to be condemned almost everywhere else. Well, that's been the way of the world for decades now. The Times says the United Nations has rejected Israel's occupation of the Golan Heights since 1967. And so I guess we need to go right along with the United Nations, this organization that just routinely calls Israel, well, everything but a terrorist state. This conference that they had yesterday, the one where Prime Minister Netanyahu just profusely thanked and praised the United States, thanked America. Listen to Netanyahu as he talks about President Trump's courage. This is clip four.
President Trump has just made history. I called him. I thanked him on behalf of the people of Israel. He did it again. First, he recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital and moved the U.S. embassy here. Then he pulled out of the disastrous Iran treaty and reimposed sanctions. But now he did something of equal historic importance. He recognized Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. And he did so at a time when Iran is trying to use Syria as a platform to attack and destroy Israel. And the message that President Trump has given the world is that America stands by Israel.
That's Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday thanking the president for this support. Now, you can. We've noted this prophecy before, Hosea 11 and verse 12, where it talks about Ephraim compassed me about with lies and the house of Israel with deceit. But Judah yet rules with God and is faithful with the saints. This is an end-time prophecy. And God says Israel, the people of Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh in particular, were just saturated in sin, lies, deceit. And yet Judah rules with God. Now, Judah's got its problems too. A lot of hypocrisy, a lot of self-righteousness. But there is an emphasis here on Judah ruling with God. If you go back into the ancient history of the Old Testament, Judah stayed with the house of David when the rest in Israel went along with Jeroboam. Judah stayed with the throne of David. And here's an end-time prophecy saying that Judah would be faithful with the saints. My father in the Hosea booklet, he talks about Mr. Armstrong's relationship with the Jews, with the authorities in Israel, the Israeli state. And he commented on how that relationship would continue during the years of the Philadelphia Church of God. I talked some about that just yesterday on the program. My father's recent coworker letter, the miracles that have worked out, the open doors, the opportunities in Israel, little Israel, and this little church, God's work. There's a lot yet to be done. Isaiah chapter 40 brings that out. Declaring to the cities of Judah, behold your God. The cities of Judah, they need God's message. They need hope in this dying world. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll delve into the Old Testament book of Esther. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this
is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
I'm so excited. We're so excited, Sarah and I, to have you here, but especially on this evening. This is the eve of Purim, and we have a miracle of Purim. We call it Nes Purim.
Nes Purim. This is Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday again thanking the United States, thanking President Trump for this miracle of Purim. Purim is a Jewish holiday that commemorates God saving the Jewish people from the wicked Haman who hatched this plot to destroy the Jews. And Prime Minister Netanyahu even referenced some of that history yesterday. This is clip 5.
We're celebrating Purim when 2,500 years ago, other Persians, led by Haman, tried to destroy the Jewish people. They fell then. And today, 2,500 years later, again, Persians, led by Khomeini, are trying to destroy the Jewish people and the Jewish state.
That's an Israeli leader referencing some of that history. It's unusual in the world today. How many leaders in Ephraim and Manasseh? They might give a token general reference to the Bible. But here's Prime Minister Netanyahu talking about that history in Esther with Haman, this terrorist who wanted to destroy all the Jews. He wanted to kill all of them. And the same mindset is there today with the Ayatollah, with the mullahs, with the Iranian militias. With the Iranian militias in Syria, with the Iranian militias in the Syrian Golan. Oh, yes. Facing some of the same problems, the same hatred, the same hostility. We'd do well to look into books like Esther, to learn lessons from some of this incredible history. Esther, as you know from the story there, she was one of the most beautiful women of her day. Xerxes, he's called Ahasuerus in the Book of Esther's, but Xerxes was searching the land for the most beautiful, the most respectful, the most submissive woman that he could find. And, of course, none of the king's advisors at the time he was going about this selection, none of them knew that Esther was, well, that she happened to be a Jew. And then you have this plot to kill the Jews. It's a fascinating story. And it's true. It's a true story. That plot in the end, it was turned on Haman, thanks to Esther and her uncle Mordecai. But look at some of these verses. I'll have to paraphrase a fair bit of it. It's a fairly long book, what, 9 or 10 chapters, I think it is. But you can see the dispute that Xerxes had with his wife in chapter 1, and then chapter 2, it comes time for him to select a new queen, and the king had Mordecai at the time. The Jew was, this was Esther's uncle, he was serving as one of the king's gatekeepers. And so it says in Esther 2 and verse 6, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, speaking of Mordecai, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So the Jews, of course, they were conquered by Babylon sometime before this, I guess about a century before this. Persia was now the world-ruling empire, and that's the history. That's the period that we're talking about here. Verse 7, it says, and he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. So Mordecai took her in as his very own. This was like a father-daughter relationship. And so anyway, Mordecai then, he checks in on his daughter down in verses 11 and 12. She was being prepared as one of the potential wives for this king, this Persian king. Verse 17, this is in chapter 2, it says, and the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in the sight more than all the virgins, so that she set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So here's this Persian king. This is happening around, I think, 478 B.C., and here's God working behind the scenes. That's the bigger story here. God's hand was at work. Because the Jews, God's people, they were about to be persecuted. It says in verse 20, Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people as Mordecai had charged her. So Mordecai said, just keep quiet about your background. She obeyed that. And so she didn't reveal the fact that she was Jewish. Verse 1 of chapter 3, it says, and after these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. So Haman enters into the story as the plot thickens here. And all the king's servants, it says, that were at the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman. All of them, of course, except Mordecai. He didn't do this. He wasn't just out there blatantly refusing to do this. He just discreetly kept to himself, but he certainly didn't bow to this Haman. The rest of them, they treated Haman like he was a god. And, of course, as soon as they noticed that Mordecai didn't bow, they went and told on him. And Haman was irate. Haman thought, well, it's not just him. He's not the one alone that should be punished. We should punish every single Jew in the kingdom. And so that's what brought on this evil plot. Verse 8, and Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of the kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people, neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore, it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. Why are we letting these people dwell in our midst? They're different. They observe different laws. They have different beliefs. They study from the Old Testament. Verse 9 says, if it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. Now, he had just had an unsuccessful campaign in Greece, and Xerxes needed some money. So Haman could carry out this mass genocide And Xerxes could fill the coffers with money. Verse 10, it says, and the king took his ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of this Agagite, the Jew's enemy. So he basically gave Haman the authority to carry out this wicked plot. It was to unfold over the course of a year, 11 months. This decree goes out. It happens right before Passover in that year. What did I say? 478, I think it was. In any event, verse 13, it says, and the letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for prey. So this was to be an absolute and total slaughter. They were to kill the Jews and then take over their property and hand it over, the proceeds, hand it over to the king. So Mordecai finds out about this wicked plot, and he rents his clothes, he puts on sackcloth and ashes, he cries out to God. He mourns this decree. He turns to God with fasting and weeping and wailing. And of course, the queen, Esther, she finds out about this and reacts the same way. How are we going to save the Jews? The decree has been made. It has the king's signet. Well, Esther and Mordecai, they discuss this this wicked turn in the government. What should we do? Verse 15, this is in Esther 4. Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer, go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast you for me. So it was determined that Esther needed to go to the king about this. And that was a very risky step on her part. So she says, you better tell all the Jews to fast for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. If she didn't have good cause, well, he could have just put her to death. This was the king of Persia, after all. But this queen, this remarkable queen, was a woman of God. A woman of courage, a woman with a beautiful attitude. Verse 17, so Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. And so they humbled themselves, the Jewish people, they humbled themselves before God. And it was on the third day of this fast that Esther went in to the king. She had to be nervous. But she had God on her side. She had God to inspire her thoughts, her words. Verse 2 of chapter 5, it says, And it was so when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. And so Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. And then said the king unto her, what will you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? It shall be even given you to the half of the kingdom. Whatever you request, I'll give it to you. Verse 4, it says, and Esther answered, if it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him. So she had a plan herself, and she wanted to patiently see it out. She didn't just blurt out, save the Jews. She had thought this through. She prayed about it. She prepared this banquet. Verse 9, it says, and then went Haman forth that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he stood not up nor moved for him, he was full of indignation against Mordecai. He hears about the banquet. He's on cloud nine. And then he sees Mordecai. He hates Mordecai. He hates the Jews. But then he carries on, talking to his wife, Haman, his friends, talking about constructing gallows 75 feet high, where Mordecai can be tortured and hanged before all in the city. He was gloating. Verse 1 of chapter 6, it says, "And on that night could not the king sleep, and he commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king." Now, who do you suppose is orchestrating this? He reads from the book of records, probably because he wanted to go back to sleep. It probably wasn't really exciting reading. But do you know what he heard from that account? From whatever page he turned to? He heard about this wicked plot on him, this assassination plot, this assassination attempt. And it was brought to his attention by the gatekeeper, Mordecai. Mordecai, Esther's uncle, had saved his life. That's a pretty unusual twist and turn to this story. God had a hand in the insomnia. God had a hand in the record book that was brought to the king. God had a hand in what page was read to the king. And so the king is hearing this and then wondering, has anyone rewarded Mordecai for this act of valor? So verse 6, Haman comes in. This is the next day. And the king said to him, "What shall be done unto the man whom the king delights to honor?" He wanted to honor Mordecai, and Haman thought he was talking about Haman. Haman thought in his heart, "To whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself? He must be talking about me. He must be wanting to praise and to honor me." Verse 7, "And Haman answered the king, 'For the man whom the king delights to honor, let the royal apparel be brought which the king uses to wear, and the horse that the king rides upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head. And let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man with all whom the king delights to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" And then, read verse 10. "The king said to Haman, 'Make haste, and take the apparel and the horse, as you have said, just as you have suggested, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew that sits at the king's gate, and let nothing fail of all that you have spoken.'" So not only did Haman have to carry this out, as you can see from the rest of the story, he had to lead the procession honoring Mordecai. Verse 14, it says, "And while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared." So the story is not over. He was out leading the procession of honor for Mordecai, and we still haven't made it to the banquet yet. That's in chapter 7. So Haman is there, the king is there, Esther is there, she's hosting it. Verse 3 says, "Then Esther the queen answered and said, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, and I, my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage.'" They were sold unto death. Haman had offered the king these thousands of talents of silver if he could just massacre the Jews, and the plan was about to be carried out. So the king, this is verse 5, the king answered and said to Esther, "Who is he, and where is he, that does presume in his heart to do this?" And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." This wicked Haman, who sits right before us. It says, "Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen." And so the tables had completely turned. And this is something that unfolded over time, this plan. It wasn't just a quick conversation. It wasn't just a quick prayer and then a simple request before the king and everything's taken care of. It's like we said yesterday with that example, the plane flight down to Jerusalem, just walking forward in faith one step at a time. There was the mourning, there was the wailing, there was the fasting and praying. And then the conversations, and then the banquet. And then now finally, the tables completely turn, as I say. Verse 7, "And the king, arising from the banquet of wine, in his wrath, went into the palace garden, and Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen." Here's Haman pleading for his life before Esther the Jew. "For he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king." He knew the king was angry. So the king comes back into the room where Haman was. In despair with Esther, here's Haman pleading for his life. The king fuming by this point. Verse 9, it says, "And Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said to the king, Behold, also the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, stands in the house of Haman." Well, how convenient. He was working on a set of gallows anyway. And then the king said, "Hang him thereon." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And then the king's wrath was pacified. So Haman got what he deserved in the end. And the Jews were spared. The Jews avoided this massacre, this genocide. And you can see why the Jews, even to this day, celebrate this history with a national holiday. The miracle of Purim. Verse 1 of chapter 8, it says, "On that day did the king, Ahasuerus, give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen." And so it just gets better and better for the Jews. That's the way it works when we look to God for deliverance, when we trust God for protection. When we ask God to render his judgment, judgment is God's. Let God take matters like this into his hands. Let God intervene. This is what happens when you fast and pray before God. And then, yes, get up and act. Do your part, step by step. But follow God. Follow God through all the way to victory. So many lessons to take away from this. You look at the way that the story unfolds. What happens when you're a faithful gatekeeper or you're a deeply converted young lady? What happens when you humbly submit to God's rule, trusting in God? What happens when you patiently wait on God to intervene, to take care of the problem? God, as you see here, God won't hesitate to intervene in really mysterious ways, even working through a king, a Gentile king, turning the tables. Look what happens when we walk by faith instead of sight. When we let God work things out his way instead of imposing our will on every circumstance. God is, he is a God of love and mercy. He's a miracle-making God. He performs miracles for those who look to him in faith. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for being with us all through the week. We'll see you Monday.